The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, The Guardian's numero uno supremo technology podcast. This is an all-inclusive audio recording, and so hello to the 79% of people who, according to an Ipsos Mori podcasting poll, are listening on your home computer, and to the 66% who are listening on your MP3 players. We are proud to be part of the 1.8 podcasts you listen to each week. And now to our esteemed podding team, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Welcome to you two. Have you heard any interesting statistics this week?
I know that 99.9% of statistics are completely made up on the spot.
Well, I quite like the fact that those two numbers you just said add up to 145%.
Absolutely. I think it has to do with the fact that there are 1.8 podcasts that you listen to, which means that you listen to more than one podcast. So some you might listen to.
Don't make
See,
me,
I'm deconstructing.
Don't make me crack out my GCSE
maths. I'm deconstructing. Well...
So what's the 0.8 podcast? I guess that means you sort of give up halfway, four-fifths of the way through.
And you certainly wouldn't do that here, would you?
Because we've come around.
Indeed, because on today's pod, we're getting smart. Smart about what we touch, smart about what we do, and smart about what we share. Bobby Johnson meets some of the smartest materials on the planet. The materials are actually cleverer than some people. While Jemima demands smart answers about data ownership from the head of Facebook in Europe. It's all on this week's Tech Weekly, so grab your thinking caps and get smart. We shall raise your IQ over the next 30 minutes or your money back, so stay tuned. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with the kind of world where cars flew, clothing talked with billboards, and you could change your nail polish color with the touch of a digital pen. Yes, I was completely taken with the way technologies enhanced the materials in the films of Paul Verhoeven and Ridley Scott, and figured that by the time I was grown up, everything would be impregnated with nanotechnology. It's the stuff of science fiction, yet all the public has seen in this wild future are hypercolor t-shirts that change color in awkward places. Jemima, you want to...
I really want one. I've been looking on eBay.
Bobby's joined us briefly in the studio, and before he runs off to interview Adam and Joe, which you can actually read on blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology, he has seen what's behind the digital curtain. He spoke with Rob Thompson, a designer specializing in materials and manufacturing, about the new materials that are out there. So what did he have to say, Bobby?
Well, as you say, you know, we have been promised a lot of these swizzy new technologies for a very long time. But finally, maybe they're starting to happen. I went to talk to Rob, who's a fellow of the Royal College of Art and an expert in material science and the processes for manufacturing these new things. And I had a long chat with him about various bits and bobs. But one of the things I started off by asking him was about nanotechnology. After all, you know, at the moment, nano is thrown around here, there and everywhere. It seems like scientists and researchers try and use nanotechnology to make what they're doing sound sexier. So I asked him, is that true? What is nanotechnology and how does it affect the processes of the materials we use every day?
Nanotechnology is not that new. I mean, the first examples of it were in stained glass windows in the form of nanoparticles of gold. And at a nanoscale level, gold is actually red in colour. So red stained glass is produced in that way. Similarly, white pigments are titanium dioxide. So toothpaste is full of the stuff, as are sun creams and some cosmetics. Now, of course, that raises some concerns about the safety of these materials because they're becoming more and more ubiquitous in our sort of daily lives. But at the same time, there are huge developments and areas of innovation that are very exciting and that have amazing potential for the future.
What are some of the nanotech materials or ways of doing things that you've seen that we might see come to pass in the future or just really exciting?
Well, one of those materials is something known as aerogel. It comes under many different names, but it was developed by NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Japan. And I've actually brought a sample with me here. Now, it looks like smoke because it's about 97, 98% air. So it's almost not there. You can't feel the weight of it on your hand. It's an incredible material that's basically glass, but that's foamed at a nanoscale level. So you get a huge internal surface area, and that means you get huge insulation properties. So this is so far the lightest material known to man and the most insulating material known to man. So you can imagine the potential for this material in the future.
I couldn't even see it in the bag when you got it out there. It's kind of almost invisible, really. But it's, yeah. when you hold it up to light, I mean, it does look like kind of mist sitting in your hand. You can see straight through it. It just looks unreal the way it sits there. But it is, I notice, it's incredibly brittle as well, isn't it? There must be problems with that if you're going to use it for insulation.
Yes. At the moment, the examples that I've seen are performance applications, like, for example, as a composite core material in sports equipment. But the potential for the future, once this material is harnessed, is in, say, as a composite core in laminated glass. So you're actually using a single material but foaming the internal panel to create a super insulating glass that's actually much thinner than what we're commonly used to in double glazing at the moment.
Are there other things that floated your boat?
There's a huge amount of very exciting innovation going on in the UK at the moment. And I was privileged to see some of those companies, like the Welding Institute in Cambridge and Superform Aluminium in near Coventry. Superform have in the 1980s, they developed a process of forming metal in a similar way to plastic thermoforming. So you heat the metal up to around 450 degrees and it becomes super elastic, in that you can stretch it hundreds of times its length without it breaking. So you can inflate the material with air and then suck it down onto a mould and create complex shapes out of a single sheet. And it's already being used in the rail industries to build trains, train fronts, nose cones for aeroplanes and racing cars. Some very exciting applications.
I haven't necessarily noticed trains made out of one single huge sheet of aluminium or anything. What are the problems to rolling some of these cutting edge technologies out?
Obviously cost, because where something is very new, it maybe hasn't been proven over time to do the job as well as maybe more traditional materials, but also it's a limited supply. North Sails in the States, who developed three-dimensional laminating sails, they can build a sail in one piece of material, which means huge weight saving on racing boats, and now every yacht in the Volvo Ocean Race is fitted with one of these North Sails 3DLs, because without it you're at a disadvantage. But the problem is there's only one factory in Nevada making these products, so it's, you know, they've got a huge waiting list.
Some of the other projects you work on that you've mentioned are about how you insert better technologies into kind of existing framework. So could you go through some of that for us?
Another project I'm working on that's very interesting at the moment is the Smart Pods project at the Royal College of Art. Now, we're working with many different institutions, including Loughborough University, University of Bath, University of Bristol, University of West of England and Plymouth. And we've come together to try and bring innovation to the next generation of ambulances.
We know ambulances at the moment, you know, they've not changed dramatically over many years. So what you're looking at is a new way of doing it rather than just stuffing more into the same old box.
Yeah, ambulances have already got a lot of technology integrated into them, and some of it's very advanced. Now, the reason why ambulances haven't changed much over the years is because they're based on modifying commercial vehicles, because it's the most practical way of developing vehicles that are roadworthy, safe, and people understand how to drive and what they're capable of. But what we're looking at in the future is new vehicles that evolve as a result of new services that are directed at delivering care in the community, as opposed to rushing people to hospital.
That was Rob Thompson from Creative Resource Lab. Now, unfortunately, Bobby's had to leave, but Charles, you claim to be a bit of an expert about nanotechnology, and so it's a shame that Bobby had to leave, but thankfully you're going to step into his shoes.
I've been writing about nanotechnology on and off for ages, it feels like. I mean, it's, as we said, it's not a new idea. Richard Feynman, who was one of the verifiable geniuses of the 20th century, suggested that in a speech called Plenty of Room at the Bottom, that there's lots of ways to build really sort of atom molecular-sized machines and materials, and there are nanoscale things that you can buy in the shops all the time. Suntan Lotion's one, Foundation for Women. You know, actually, the biggest user of nanotechnology at the moment is actually cosmetics.
Do you think that people recognise this? Do you think that they're aware of this on a general scale?
Well, no, because, I mean, certainly in the cosmetics industry, they tend not to use words like nanotechnology, although they use all sorts of other, you know, nutritious.
Oh, yeah. There's the science of it. What about pentapeptides?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that nanotechnology?
I think they're a bit bigger than, you know. But, I mean, there's, for example, Gap, and certainly in the States, has been marketing for some years now jeans which have nanofibers woven into them so that if you pour liquids onto it, it just goes straight off. There's you know, nothing to wipe out. And I've seen a demonstration of it where they did this. And this is at least 4 or 5 years ago.
When I think about technology, I think about something that uses energy. I think about something that usually needs to be plugged into the mains in order to charge up or whatever, or solar power or whatever. How do these nano fibers, for example, how do these nano bits that are in the foundation in your makeup, how do they actually power themselves? How do they work? Or do they have a limited span?
That's one of the things is that at the nanoscale, very difficult to do the powering. And in effect, they're passive technologies. They're something that's simply there. That's, you know, the fibers are woven in with the foundation or the sun cream lotion in the gel so that they don't actually do anything. They don't have power, you know, generated from them, but they have an effect in the way that they enhance the behavior of the material.
Technologically, they're engineered cells.
Yes, engineered that, yeah. Cells, exactly. Yeah.
See, I suppose that's, you know, like your sort of GM foods. I'm not in any way making an ascension.
Genetically modified genes.
But that kind of thing. So it's actually not technology in the sense of it being, you know, a computer, a little spider robot. See, this is what I imagine is like little spider robots crawling into my eyes.
Well, the trouble with a lot of nanotechnology sort of engines and so on is that they, when you get down to that sort of size, then you get all sorts of other weird atomic effects which start to come into play, which mean that you don't have friction at the large scale, but you have friction at the very, very tiny scale, the atomic scale, the called van der Waals forces. And this is a new sort of problem that they're having to get around now.
And are there any potential dangers associated with these things?
Well, Prince Charles always worries about us having self-replicating nanobots which will eat the world and turn it into grey goo. That's pretty unlikely to happen. You've got to really say that there's a long way to go still. It's one, you know, nanotechnology is one of these things that's been forecast for a long time. It's a bit like Brazil, you know, it's the future and always will be.
Well, thank you very much, Charles. And also thanks to Rob Thompson for exposing some of these crazy, seriously quite mad and amazing things. You can actually see some of them on his blog. But let's step back from the future and get settled into the present. Here's Jemima with the news.
Google is being forced to hand over personal information from everyone who's ever watched a video on YouTube. A New York judge said the data on more than 100 million people must be handed to Viacom, the media firm conducting a $1 billion lawsuit against Google for copyright infringement. Version 3 of Firefox entered the Guinness Book of World Records for the most downloads in one day. Mozilla's web browser hit more than 8,002,000 downloads during June and also ate into Internet Explorer's market share, accounting for 19.3% of browser use. Virgin Media has teamed up with the BPI to send warning letters to 800 customers, warning them not to download music illegally. The original letter tells customers that after 3 warnings, their connection will be terminated, although Virgin subsequently said the wording was a mistake. And in other Google news, the search giant has begun to introduce its Street View feature to London. An elaborate camera car has reportedly been spotted in the capital, to the alarm of privacy campaigners who aren't convinced Google's face-blurring technology goes far enough.
Thank you very much, Jemima. So let's tackle Google Street View. This is something that I think Europe has been having a lot of trouble with, yet suddenly it's happening, you know, and we are getting Street View and people's faces are being put into this technology. Well, how are people coping with it?
We get the impression that Google's being not cagey exactly, but they're not being completely transparent about exactly which streets are being done, presumably because they don't want people to line the streets and wave so that they can say that they're going to be featured in Street View. But they did have problems in the States. There was one house where you could see into somebody's lounge and you could see their cat sitting on their windowsill. And, I mean, there are all sorts of kind of possible scenarios you could imagine for photographing people where they shouldn't be. But as somebody commented on one of our blogs later on, it seems a bit of a double standard for people to say that they're very concerned about being photographed on Street View
when everyone just photographs and blogs and tweets and videos themselves doing everything these days.
Not everyone. Not everyone, you know, and we are a minority. We are those people who engage with those technologies. And I think we talked about this last week when we were saying how we consume blogs and how we consume these technologies. You know, I don't think my mother would like very much to be on Street View. I don't think my dad would like very much to be on Street View. And they don't life blog. They don't do all these types of things. And if suddenly they found out that they were in a situation where they may not want to be recognized, not suggesting, of course, that my parents would be in such situations. However, there is something that the privacy campaigners are actually standing for. We as technologists and people who are interested in this area know our rights and recognize it, but not everybody does when it comes to these types of things. Yes, and of course, Flickr's had trouble as well.
Well, the way that Google's getting around this is by saying that they've introduced face blurring technology. So you might be standing, I blogged this earlier, but you might be standing at your lounge window in your pants and your face will be blurred out, but, you know, everything
how
else
can be
there.
People to do that.
I think basically we need to set up a Facebook group and coordinate everyone. We need to find out when Google is you know, what the camera car route is and get everyone to stand in their windows in their pants.
Well, more on that later.
Yes.
Very nicely segued, Jemima, but actually I'd like to pull back before we get into that and briefly talk about the Viacom YouTube story, because that was, I heard that last week and my ears kind of went, wow!
This is a really horrific judgment. I mean, it's very difficult not to have a very fusty, out-of-date image of what judges are like. But, you know, if he'd said, we want you to hand over all the data that's relevant to Viacom, you could just about understand it. But all the data from every YouTube user ever, and I have only ever looked at relatively benign stuff, and some of it has probably been illegal because you don't even know what is pirated and what isn't. But even so, that's pretty terrifying. And I'm quite liberal when it comes to your kind of what people do with your data online.
And it's also an international issue as well, because this was something in the States, and yet over here we are implicated in this as well. So there's a lot of issues that are thrown into both of these news stories.
And Viacom's doing this to really test the ground, because what happens with the outcome of this case is going to dictate what every media company does about their pirated content.
What's not entirely clear is quite what Viacom is hoping to find out.
How are they going to process the user data of 100 million people? I mean, that's not even the number of video
Very
clips they watch.
Very slowly.
Billions. Yes.
We'll find out in 10 years' time. I think we'll talk a little bit about this in the next feature item that we're going to be coming to in the podcast. But before we do, I had a question. You mentioned Firefox 3 there and the downloads. And I was wondering, last week I was looking up places to stay in the Poconos in the US. And I was using Firefox on my Mac, and I went to a website, and bam, suddenly everything shut down, and I got my little pop-up saying, you know, you have been hacked, and click on this link, and everything will be okay, and we'll, you know, the typical thing that happens when you fall into a site like this.
Were these Firefox dialogues?
Yes,
or were
they
these
were Firefox dialogues. They were Firefox dialogues.
That actually can be driven by JavaScript.
But does this mean that suddenly if Firefox is ahead of Internet Explorer and ahead of all of the other competitors, does this mean that we're going to see more attacks, we're going to see more viruses, we're going to see more things like this, pop-ups, et cetera, coming through on Firefox? Because, to be honest, I've been living in quite a happy little comfortable, you know, Firefox duvet, thinking, well, it can't happen to me because it's
open source. Trying to get a new browser.
Well, yeah, but except the JavaScript is cross-browser. You know, you would have got that probably if you were using Safari or using Camino, or if you were using anything. So are you going to see more Firefox-specific attacks? You might. They'll sort of look around to see what sort of things are not working and are working in it. But Firefox 3, although they found a security hole pretty much the instant it was being downloaded by all the X million people, I think that's been fixed now. But you can expect that, yeah, there'll be people poking and prodding at the edges of Firefox as much as anything, because people think that it's, you know, enormously safe, which it isn't necessarily so.
Well, you can find out about these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. At last week's Together 08, a gathering of social entrepreneurs and digital policymakers brought to you by Channel 4, our own Jemima took to the stage with Facebook's European head, Blake Chandley. And in front of a throng, you drilled him, Jemima, on demanding questions like IPOs and targeted advertising. Did he crack?
Okay, so Chandler's recently had his remit expanded, so he's not just looking after the UK, he's looking after Europe now. But I wanted to know what Facebook's plans are for developing their targeted advertising, because it's absolutely critical to the development of a lot of online businesses that they develop really valuable advertising, and the way to do that is by targeting that.
Consumers don't dislike advertising, right? They dislike bad and irrelevant advertising, same as any medium in the world. What the internet allows us to do is understand who consumers are a little bit better and to serve them more relevant advertising in a more relevant time. So if I'm going to buy a car in the next 60 days, wouldn't that be something an advertiser that Ford or Toyota want to know, serve me an advertisement, and that might be relevant for me, right? That's not something I dislike unless it's done in an appropriate way. Within social environments, consumers have even higher expectations, okay? And especially within Facebook, more so than maybe some of the other players who are more content-driven, then Facebook, you're having a relationship with your friends and family. You're not there consuming content in the way that we typically define content as professionally produced content. We as advertisers and the advertising community needs to respect that. We need to understand why consumers, what the state of mind they're in when they're there, and how to integrate the brand into part of the conversation. And I think we're in very early stages of that. We launched a platform called Facebook Ads, which is us, you know, trying to tie in and use consumers to actually become trusted referrals for brands. So if I go in and I become a fan of the Coca-Cola page, a number of my friends are going to see that. Organically, they'll see that as part of a social story, as we call it, and we allow the brand to amplify that through the smart
social web.
But
how have people really responded to that? Because I'm not. If somebody told me they like Coke, I think I probably wouldn't really take much notice.
No, but if someone said I went in and just did a review on the Indiana Jones movie from the weekend, or Sex and the City, and it's a good friend of yours posted a review, you might go see that review, okay? You referenced Beacon, I mean, and this is something that I keep having to say over and over again. Beacon was never launched as an ad platform. What people do on Facebook is they share what they're doing. I posted my photos from my son and I from last weekend when we were at the cricket. I became a fan of whatever group I become a fan of. I did whatever I did, and that's what my friends see. And I expect them to see those social actions. All Beacon was designed to do is say, instead of just talking about what you're doing on Facebook, here's what you're doing off of Facebook. Okay, so I'm renting a movie from Blockbuster. I'm renting the latest Top Gun movie from Blockbuster. We can have a long chat about whether we launched it correctly. And we think we launched it with the greatest intent to allow people to share more transparently what they're doing around the web. The way we did it, where we actually had it be an opt-out versus opt-in, was probably inappropriate. And our consumers shouted at us, and we changed it pretty quickly. Yeah. But brands weren't paying to be involved in that. They weren't paying to deliver those messages. I think there's a real misconception of what Beacon was.
Do you think there's maybe a sense that people are developing an idea of how valuable their personal data is, and that they're slightly reluctant, really, to hand that over to Facebook because they know you're going to be able to make money from it?
Well, but listen, it's funny. Mark Zuckerberg, who's our founder, is one of the most interesting and altruistic people I've ever met. His objective is to connect the world. Make no bones about it, right? He thinks he can make the world a better place by allowing people to interact with each other more efficiently and more effectively. There's always going to be a commercial element to what we do because you have to pay for the server power in order to, we've got 6 billion photos on Facebook, right? That's double the size of all other photos online combined.
You're profitable,
right?
Now.
We're a profitable company. We're privately held companies, so we don't talk about the exact numbers. But Mark's always said he wants to make a dollar more than what it takes to operate the company. And that's kind of how we're following it right now.
So is he going to IPO the company?
I can't talk about that, Jemima. There are other people that know much more. I'm a simple guy in Europe. People spend all day long thinking and hypothesizing around that in Silicon Valley.
That was Blake Chandley from Facebook. So, Jemima, how do you think consumers are learning about the value of their data? I thought that was such a really good question.
Well, the point I was trying to get at is that consumers are obviously very savvy, they're spending a lot of time online, and I think people know that the huge amount of information they put online is generating a lot of money for people. They see the amount of revenues for companies like Google, and they are developing a sense that there's a commercial value to this. So when Facebook launched Beacon and it didn't really go that smoothly, people kind of resented the fact that their data was being taken to and from other places and brought into the site because they felt they didn't have enough control over it. And that really is the key issue. It's about control of this data.
Especially if they, as you say, you know, they're taking information from, you know, this is what I'm renting at Blockbuster and suddenly everybody knows this.
There's a balance to be sought because people don't mind giving up their data or spending their time on something if they get something back from that. And Facebook has quite controversially not supported Google Friend Connect and could be doing more to make its data more shareable. But when I go to a new website and I want to set up a profile, I have to do it again every single time I go to another website. Why can we not just set all our data up once and then transfer that? It's our data and we should be able to do that. And he didn't really answer the question, unfortunately.
Do you think it's a generational thing, though, this notion of ownership of data, this notion of understanding how valuable your data is online?
I don't think it's generational. I think it's about attitude and your aptitude as well to the internet. And I don't think people that use the internet are of a certain generation. I think they're people with a certain inclination.
What does Facebook do with the data, though? This is a question that I wanted to expand out to you, Charles, when you're thinking about the Free Our Data campaign that you've been working with. What is it that the organizations do? It probably depends very much on whether it's a public or a private organization. Facebook, what do they do with the data that they have?
Arguably, actually, Facebook isn't doing very much with the data at the moment because I'm still being served ads for baldness and weight loss. I'm not saying I'm the body beautiful, but yeah, I think I'm relatively okay in that department. They could be using the data that they've got more. So perhaps almost unfairly, maybe, that they've been subject to a lot of scrutiny over this. But if you look at a company like Google and the contextual ads they have next to all your emails and all of the other pies that Google has their fingers in, even branching into health records now, that's a far more extensive body of data that they're collecting. And yes, people are asking questions of Google and they're being brought to account in some ways, but they should be more of a concern if we do see this as a concern.
That's a public enterprise. But when we think about what the government is collecting on us through things like the OS types of things, what do they use that data for?
Well, this is one of the things, is that the government gathers huge amounts of generalized, sort of non-personal data. There's, you know, Ordnance Survey does mapping, Environment Agency does things about environment. And, for example, Office of National Statistics gathers all sorts of generalized information, which is sort of refined down to postcodes, down to neighborhoods. And in many cases, they don't quite know what to do with it. You know, they know they've got a lot of it, but their position isn't one where they're thinking about, okay, now we've got all this data, what should we do with it? How do we stick it together and make something better? And this has actually been one of the things that the Free Our Data campaign, which we've been running since March of 2006, this is one of the things we've been saying, which is that if you let this non-personal data, and I really stress the non-personal thing to people, if you let it out to private organizations, you know, people out in the private sector, in the charitable sector, whatever, you know, area you want, then they'll come up with really good things to do. And this week, the government came up with the goods on this. They've started a competition called Show Us a Better Way. And, one has to give big props to Tom Watson, who's the Cabinet Office Minister, who very much subscribes to the Free Our Data agenda and who had a reception at number 11 Downing Street. We were there. And said, you know, that he thinks the Free Our Data campaign is a really good idea. It could triumph. Those were his words.
It's not insignificant that this project was partly developed by Tom Loosemore, who used to be the BBC's head of Web2 and has gone on to Ofcom to develop their public service publisher idea, and is also involved with the My Society guys. So this is part of a movement of freeing data
generally.
There's
a really big movement. And, it's not just Tom Watson. There are other ministers within government. There's Michael Wills at the Ministry of Justice. There's Jim Knight at the Department of Education. Baroness Federa at the Department of Business, Environment, Regulatory Reform, which used to be DTI. These are all people who really subscribe to the idea that if you make this data available, people will find really good things to do with it. So the showusabetterway.com is where you can go and enter. Just suggest ideas for things to do with government data. There are hundreds, literally, of suggestions here. Just, you know, pulling randomly. Tainted air map. Mapped data of air quality and health issues by date and diagnosis. Average Joe. Dynamic page which allows you to retrieve data on the average man, woman and child in the UK. Where does my money go? Web application that would interactively represent UK budgetary information using maps, timelines, best of breed visualisation.
It's all very, very interesting. You can find out more and see all the updates on the Guardian's Free Our Data campaign page, which is freeourdata.org.uk. And you can listen to the whole Facebook interview with Jemima and with Blake Chandley at blogs.guardian.co.uk/digital content.
I'm Alok Jha, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, we discuss dark energy and the even darker matter of the gender gap with astrophysicist Sarah Bridle, recipient of the 2008 Women in Science Fellowship. Also in the podcast, we hear from comedian Bill Bailey about his admiration for Alfred Russel Wallace, the forgotten hero of evolution. Plus, good news for stem cell researchers, bad news for mercury, and the science of jelly. It's all in the new Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
So speaking of blogs, what have you been saying this week, people out there in digital content, Jemima?
Well, I mentioned this earlier, actually, but Google is street viewing you right now. There was a brilliant photo on TechCrunch UK of a car with a very, very big, very elaborate kind of War of the Worlds style camera on top filming us, which kind of inspired a brief comment thread. But it was Brian Tist, actually, who raised the point that, you know, why are people really concerned about this? He said, one minute everyone wants CCTV everywhere and kids line up by the millions to get online and on TV. Then we want our faces blurred by Google. Surely if the van just has a loudhailer going, cheese, before each shot, everyone would be happy. And Dr. Fegg added on the end a link to an ICANN Has Cheeseburger Classic, which is actually a still of the cat in the window, obviously, being ICANN Has Cheeseburger, saying, oh, hi, Googles, ICANN Has Privacy.
I've got a quick question about the Google car. I saw it when it was in San Francisco.
Did you?
I did. But it wasn't, but it didn't have like a War of the Worlds thing on it. It had like a three-dimensional model of the city.
Well, you know, this could always be
amazing.
This could always be a joke kind of photoshopped mock-up. And this also was not branded with Google like the one in America was. So, you know, maybe it's just a hoax and we're all just wasting our time here.
Over on the games blog, we've been talking about the merits of keeping your gamer achievements to yourself. I think there was something to do with the PlayStation 3 opening things up, and people were saying you could show your trophies off to people, and suddenly it was all about your trophies. And Ivor B says, "Great, now everyone can see what a meticulous gamer I am." Not. I haven't actually finished playing a game in ages, and I certainly don't have time to sit around playing a game multiple times looking for various trophies. So now I have to bear the mark of shame of being a gamer of a low level. This sucks. They had to go and bring leveling up into this. I don't think I could handle being a low-level gamer, so maybe I should stop sinking hundreds of hours into epic RPGs and sandbox adventures and go for the quick kills. So who knows? Who knows? All these gamer achievements and trophies and points and things may actually change the face of gaming forever. What's been going on over in technology, Charles?
Oh, well, the YouTube Viacom decision got people very stirred up. Chatterer commented, "I think that most people commenting, including Kevin Anderson, who's the Guardian's blog editor who wrote the post, seem to be conflating two things, individual privacy and Google's commercial interests. It's remarkable that an attack on Google like this is seen as an attack on individual privacy. It's not. While it may be a Pyrrhic victory for Viacom, their legal fees and trawling through the vast amount of data might turn out to be higher than their claim, it is in response to a genuine grievance that one of the world's biggest media companies, i.e. Google, is profiting from the free distribution of the intellectual property of another's. The fact that a successful attack on Google is being spun as an assault on our privacy just goes to show how deluded most people are about privacy issues on the net. Google is the most rampant hoarder of information about all of us, and not just because of its ubiquity, but out of commercial strategy. The fact that it has the information to disclose shows that it is Google that is the real threat. Now, if Facebook had the same order made against it, wow.
We're bringing it all together, aren't we, towards the end? It's beautiful.
It's data, privacy.
Knitting it all together in a beautiful cardigan.
Well, if you'd like to contribute to the ongoing conversations, please do come along for the ride at blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology/digital-content/games. And you can add your pattern to the mighty cashmere jumper of technology. Also, our new Flickr account was hit a whopping many times last week, thanks to the images of the team posted up from our road trips and also from Glastonbury. There are more up there now. People we've spied around Guardian Towers, plus pod regulars in compromising positions.
Those are the ones on YouTube, surely. The, the Samizdat video, certain people performing common people.
Don't mention the war.
And speaking of snapping people in awkward places, Charles, the Google Street View car has been spotted around the UK, as we've mentioned on several occasions, taking photos at ground level of our environments and unfortunately also of us. So we've decided to set a challenge to you this week. If you spot the easy to identify or perhaps not so easy to identify Google Street View car, do grab a snap, and extra bonus points if you get a clear picture of the driver. A taste of their own medicine, methinks. Post them up to flickr.com/groups/Guardian Tech Weekly, or you can send them to tech@guardian.co.uk and we shall add them to our site. Many thanks as well to the kind reviews of Jemima's and my performance of Common People at Glastonbury. Yes, indeed, on YouTube and also on the blogs. Needless to say, we're very relieved it's over and that that nobody tore into us too brutally.
In this Thursday's tech section with The Guardian, intellectual property enters a new age. The G8 are ratifying an anti-counterfeiting trade agreement in secret, which might let border guards inspect your laptop or MP3 player for illegal material. There's worries people will be targeted with their machines, and ISPs will be urged to finger file sharers. We ask if the new iPhone is actually more expensive than the first, despite having a lower price tag, and whether it's got competition from a new HTC Touch phone, a would-be iPhone killer. And as the US Army develops a non-lethal weapon, we ask, is it a giant super stink bomb or something that makes everywhere too slippery to function? It's all in Thursday's tech section with The Guardian.
Well, that's all we have for you this week on Tech Weekly. For those who've got this far, you are officially smarter than those who haven't. We shall be back next week at the same bat time and the same bat channel when Charles will be picking through your house looking at your storage. Many thanks to our guests, Rob Thompson and Blake Chandley, to our seasoned regulars, Charles and Jemima, and to the absent yet strangely present Bobby, and to our producer, Scott, in the box. I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.